Publishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. If you're a first-time listener, welcome to the show. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. I'm so glad to have you all here. A quick disclaimer explanation before we start. I think something does need to be explained. So there's a point in tonight's podcast where I sing, okay? Now, there's a reason for this. And by the way, it's horrible. I'm sure you're not surprised by that. But here's what's going on. I was trying to indicate to our composer, Nima, who I love, that this was a section that I actually wanted him to sing. Okay, so, but just to sort of block out the timing, I went ahead and attempted to sing a small bit of a song. Okay, now he listened to it and he's like, "You gotta keep it." I'm like, "I'm not gonna keep that." He's like, "No, it's charming. You got to just leave your voice in there. Just leave it in. It's charming." You know, look, Nima can talk me into a lot of things. And I trust Nima with my life and the music. So I was like, okay, maybe I'll leave it in. Now, I have regretted this decision ever since. But the longer it went, the more it became a thing where I couldn't back out. So anyway, the point is this. When you hear me singing, please understand, this is not me trying my... Oh, actually, it is me trying my hardest. Actually, that is what you should understand, how sad that is. Anyway, so just when it happens, be prepared, and please, please forgive me. And if you can't forgive me, just blame Nima. Okay, here we go. The Amityville Horror by Jay Anson. At Brightwood Elementary School back in 1978, seventh grade didn't start until Thursday, October 12th. Sure, we'd been showing up since the first week of September, but no one has any memory of anything happening until Melody Mayhew kissed Eddie Minette. That kiss, after school, up on the playground behind the new bungalows, it unleashed something. After that, the rest of the school year was just a blur. So many kids fell in love that year. It was crazy, the drama. Mrs. Goodwell in homeroom said she'd never seen anything like it in her 40 years of teaching. There were so many crushes and couples and makeouts and breakups, and we're talking about 12-year-olds, that for once, school was interesting. Maybe kids grew up faster then. Maybe it was disco. Whatever it was, once Melody kissed Eddie, it was all over. Everyone wanted in on the act. The academic year became academic. By Halloween, going to seventh grade was basically clubbing. You showed up to be seen and to make an impression. If you weren't being talked about in outraged whispers during nutrition, you might as well go hang out with the sixth graders. Every week, someone cried at lunch. People got slapped. Three different girls got transferred out, one of them to Highlands Elementary School, where she became insanely popular after being practically invisible at Brightwood. Later, a bunch of guys said they had always known she was hot, and one guy, Scott, claimed he'd snuck into a Highlands dance and danced slow with her and felt her up. Again, we were 12. The teachers thought they had everything under control. These urges were natural, they said. It was 1978, they said. They had been trained for this, they said. They snapped into action and scheduled a dance for the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Better to provide a safe space for the kids to naturally explore these confusing feelings. Big mistake. George Kang kissed Beatrice Alvarez right there in front of everyone during Three Times a Lady by the Commodores, and she kissed him back. If anything, this went off bigger than the Eddie Melody kiss. Up until then, the action had all been with the hot kids. Tim, Kenny, Corey, Neil, Gina, Lisa, Alice, Shiwei. Once George and Beatrice hooked up, the normals got super active. It was kind of exciting to see the hot kids act out, but once the walls came down for the rest of us, it was like there was this expectation. There was nothing holding the rest of us back but our own lack of game. Once we got back to school after Thanksgiving, there were like five times the number of couples. Even the hot kids got annoyed at how ramped up the normals got. Hey, could you all just chill out? I'll get to the Amityville Horror in a second. God. Okay, where was I? Oh, right. The normals. George and Beatrice started going to his house after school, where his parents weren't, to make out. This was just a rumor until it got confirmed by Gina, who was friends with Miyaka, who apparently saw it, or at least saw the hickeys. This was when things got weird for me. I'd gone through my entire childhood looking down on all these kids. They were a bunch of immature babies, but now they were all up on each other. I was in immediate danger of being seen as even less grown up than these losers. And it was especially galling because I'd had like a million crushes back when it wasn't cool. And now, even if I did manage to make a name for myself and put some points on the board, I'd still be miles behind so many others. It's almost like it wouldn't even count. By now, the teachers were beginning to regret talking openly and honestly with us about our changing bodies. They started wishing we'd all go back to shuffling in and out of our classes like a bunch of bored, apathetic drones. But that was never going to happen. Eddie and Melody broke up, but it didn't matter. It just meant they were single again, back on the market, fresh blood in the water, and people moved in. So the faculty doubled down and scheduled a Christmas dance. I think it was Mr. Glick who pushed it. He just wasn't going to back down and let a bunch of 12-year-old kids scare him. In the run-up to the Christmas dance, we all knew it was time to step up or shut up. You were either going to ask someone to go with you, or you were going to acknowledge that you had no business being in seventh grade. One thing was clear that year. Brightwood Elementary School was no place for kids. Like so many things in school, I pretty much accepted that I was going to be left out. I was used to it. I didn't love it, but I was used to it. Plus, it didn't really matter because in some basic way, I didn't believe it. I just didn't believe in the authenticity of the other kids' feelings. There was no way they were all in love. They were just playing at emotions, trying them on for later use. I was the only person I knew who had genuine emotions. And I would have no trouble waiting until all of this blew over. Then on Wednesday, December 13th, something happened. I met a girl named Kimberly Cortez, and everything I believed I knew about my life changed. The story I'm about to relate doesn't necessarily make me proud. In fact, some parts of it cause hot rushing shame to flood my body even to this day. But I make this bond with you now, dear listener. Everything I'm about to tell you is true. Some names have been changed for obvious reasons, but by the time it's over, I don't think any of you will doubt for a second that it all happened exactly the way I tell it. After all, you were 12 once too. Oh, for fuck's sake, okay, the Amityville Horror. The book itself was still 2 weeks in my future, but by then, I was a changed person, hopelessly and completely in love for the first time in my life. But I'll never forget pulling the brand new, sleek, shining paperback of the Amityville Horror out of my Christmas stocking. It was absolutely gorgeous. If you've seen it, you know, and if you haven't, it's in the show notes. The title is written in blood red lettering. The second vertical bar of the H in horror trails off into a barbed devil's tail, cutting through the most important words on the cover. A true story. I ran my hand over the slick cover and got my first look at that beautiful demonic house and fell in love. How could it not be haunted? The damn thing had eyes. The Amityville Horror was a non-fiction publishing phenomenon. Written by Jay Anson, it was published by Prentice Hall in September of 1977 and went through an astonishing 13 printings in its first 6 months. The paperback came out in August 1978 and sold even better. Okay, a quick rundown if you're listening to this but somehow don't know the basic story of the Amityville Horror. It goes like this. On the night of November 13th, 1974, 23-year-old Ronald DeFeo murdered his entire family with a shotgun, both parents and four siblings. The murders took place in the family home at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, Long Island. 13 months later, George and Kathy Lutz bought the house. According to the book jacket, quote, on December 18, 1975, a young family of five moved into their new home. 28 days later, they fled in terror, leaving most of their belongings behind. What they experienced in the house runs the gamut of traditional haunted house phenomenon. Cold spots, phantom odors, strange rapping sounds, an oppressive mood, plus swarms of flies, a mysterious hidden room, demonic voices, black toilets, unexplained bite marks, and a ghostly pig. Okay, not all of these things are traditional haunted house phenomenon, but I didn't know that at the time. I spent my Christmas vacation reading the book, like about a million other Americans, and reading that book would transform me. Because it was true and a bestseller, it captivated me completely. I never questioned it. I just gave myself over to it. And as scary as it was, it confirmed what I always secretly hoped and believed was true. That supernatural phenomenon really did exist. This comforted and thrilled me in an almost physical way. Every day during that Christmas vacation, I would call Kimberly Cortez and read to her my favorite parts. Those phone calls were the most romantic, passionate, and emotionally charged hours of my life up until that point. The Amityville Horror was my doorway into adulthood, and in so many ways, so was Kim. It all started before Christmas, with Mark Upshaw's freakout just after Mr. Glick's science class. Mark and I were friends, good friends, which makes everything that happened afterwards even worse. "Are you in consumer group?" Mark asked me. "Yeah," I said. "Glick chose me last week." "You gotta find out who Kim likes." It turned out Mark had a giant crush on a girl named Kimberly Cortez, and he wanted to ask her to the Christmas dance. Kimberly was new to our school, but since she wasn't in my homeroom, she wasn't on my radar. But she was definitely on Mark's radar. This was not a total surprise. A lot of people were melting down over various boys and girls, but it was strange to see Mark literally writhing with desire as he talked about her. The first meeting of Mr. Glick's consumer group was during lunch period, in 5 minutes, which meant I'd be in a room with Kimberly and about six other kids for the next hour. Mark was leaving school for the day for a doctor's appointment because he was diabetic, so he begged me to talk to her and try to find out if she A, liked anyone, B, liked Mark, and C was planning on going to the Christmas dance that Friday after school. I was totally game. I thought it'd be fun to sort of be his spy. I told Mark I'd find out whatever I could. After getting my lunch, I circled back into Mr. Glick's class. For anyone who's interested, consumer group was an extra credit activity where students would conduct surveys about consumer habits among our friends, families, and even strangers, and then submit our results to Mr. Glick and his friend, David Horowitz, a local Los Angeles consumer advocate on KNBC News. Because we were kids, there was a good chance we'd get to be on TV, and that is the only reason I was doing this. I walked into the classroom. Glick wasn't there and wouldn't be for at least 10 minutes. Kimberly was there, and I want you to know she was a perfectly pleasant-looking girl. She was not the hottest kid in seventh grade, but she was far from the bottom of the pile either. She was firmly in the upper middle, like me. Since I didn't know her, I realized I couldn't approach her directly. Instead, I went up to Lisa too and asked her if she knew Kim. I was friends with Lisa too, so I told her everything. That Mark had a big crush on Kim but didn't know if she was in a couple already. Did Lisa too know? Lisa too grabbed my hands and made crazy eyes at me and said, "Let's go find out," and dragged me over to Kim. "Kim, Richie wants to know if you have a boyfriend." Now, this could have been incredibly awkward if I had at that moment liked Kim, but I didn't. That was still a few minutes away. Kim looked at me with all the calm and class of an eighth grader and said, "Why do you want to know if I have a boyfriend?" What could I say? I told her I had a friend who wanted to ask her to the Christmas dance. I wouldn't say who it was, but if she would tell me if there was someone already on the scene, I would take that information back to him. She asked me who my friend was, and I smiled and said I obviously couldn't tell her. Then she winced and said, "Is it Mark Upshaw?" I must have looked shocked because her body sagged and she muttered, "I knew it." And I knew by the way she said it that she did not like him. And I was so glad. She leaned toward me and asked with quiet intensity, "What am I supposed to say to him?" It was a crazily intimate moment, but it felt like it made complete sense. We were both on the inside of something now. It was like we had known each other for years. It was like we were continuing a conversation we'd been having on and off our entire lives. It was thrilling. There was an of course-ness between us, and now we shared a bond, a problem we needed to solve. How were we going to break the news to Mark that she didn't like him? Before I could say another word to her, Mr. Glick walked into the room, all 5'1" of him. He had a mustache as thick as his New York accent. "All right, quiet down, everyone. Sit down. We got a lot of work to do. This isn't social hour. Richard, sit down. What are you doing bothering Kimberly?" This should have been humiliating, but it wasn't. I sat down and looked at her, and she looked at me, and the look said, "To be continued." I don't remember exactly what happened the rest of that hour, except that I flirted with her outrageously, never took my eyes or attention off her. I felt like everyone in the room was in on it, including Glick. They all knew we were the perfect couple, made for each other, and were as delighted as I was that we were finally together. When lunch was over and Glick told us to get back to our homerooms, I made my way to her, and she said, "We need to talk." I nodded. "After school? At the park?" I said. Now, asking a girl to meet you at the park was the Brightwood equivalent of asking a girl if she'd like to go to Las Vegas. Who the fuck was I? What was I doing? She said, "No, the playground." That was fine. I was fine with the playground. The next 2 hours drifted by. I felt like I was shot up with morphine. You could have stabbed me with a mechanical pencil and I wouldn't have noticed. The thing I had to know was if Kim felt the same way I did. But she had to, right? Was I going insane? Was I fantasizing? Was I falling in love? Was this what Melody and Eddie felt? George and Beatrice? It couldn't be. This was something new and strong and mine. Or maybe ours if Kim felt the same way. I had always felt older than the other kids, but in this moment, I'd never felt more adult. The bell rang and I calmly gathered my things and walked up the long cement staircase to the playground. She gave me a lopsided smile. I walked over to her. She was talking with Sandra Trujillo and Sandy G, two girls I knew by sight but had never spoken to. "Do you guys know Richard Haddam?" She said my full name. I said, "Hi," to Sandra and Sandy, feeling oddly formal. They kind of giggled and looked at me and then back at Kim. "She's told them about me." They said a quick goodbye and then got lost. Because that's obviously what she told them to do. I sat down next to her on the bench. She looked at me and said, "So." I looked at her and said, "So." Like it was an inside joke we'd always shared. Any lingering questions I had about her feelings for me were answered in that two-word exchange. We were us now, instantly, and everyone was just going to have to get used to it. Especially Mark Upshaw, and I did not give a fuck about Mark Upshaw. She didn't like him. That wasn't my fault. She liked me. Tough shit. Kim was nicer about it. She was a nice person. She felt bad for him and didn't want him to be hurt. At the same time, what could we do? She was going to see him in homeroom first thing tomorrow. She'd talk to him, but it never occurred to either of us not to follow up on our feelings. Something was clearly going on between us, and it was bigger than both of us, and we didn't have any choice in the matter. There were no ethics at all. We talked, but I don't know what we talked about. The subtext was, "I know, right?" And the feeling was, finally. Nothing was a surprise. Everything was confirmation. Suddenly, I was in no hurry. We had all the time in the world. After a while, We started walking around the abandoned playground, as if by some mutual understanding and agreement, until we were behind the new bungalows. I wasn't nervous at all. I said, "I want to kiss you." She said, "I know. I want to kiss you too, and I'm going to kiss you, but not right now. My dad's going to be here in like 5 minutes." I was crestfallen, and she must have seen it in my eyes because she said, "If I kiss you now, I might not want to stop." I turned 13, and then 18, and then 25, and then 30 in the course of that afternoon. Worlds were hurtling through space. Epochs were flashing by in an instant. Cities were built and destroyed and rebuilt and redestroyed and built again that afternoon. What was happening? We walked back down the stairs and through the school and out onto the sidewalk just as her dad drove up. He was enormous, like a grizzly bear crammed into a Chevy Nova with a cigarette. He pulled to a stop, then turned his giant head and looked through the open passenger window at his daughter and then at me, and he knew. And he hated me. As instantly as his daughter loved me, he hated me. I could feel it coming off him in waves. It was perfect. "Dad, this is Richard. He hung out with me so I wouldn't have to wait for you alone."
"Well, wasn't that nice of him?"
His voice sounded like a bucket of rocks rolling down a coal chute. I started to say something, but he had already turned away, staring through the windshield as cigarette smoke curled up around his face. Kim got in the car, then looked at me nervously, like she was suddenly afraid of our connection breaking. "See you tomorrow?" I nodded and said extra loud so her dad would hear, "I will absolutely see you tomorrow." It probably didn't come across as badass as it felt at the time, but it made her smile. Her father nodded slowly, as if confirming something to himself. I thought I saw the hint of a lizard-like smile. But really, what was the guy gonna do? Kill me? A kid? "Nice meeting you, Mr. Cortez."
"Nice meeting you too, Richard."
He looked directly at me when he said my name, delivering layers of meaning in that single word. The car pulled away from the curb and rolled down the street. I waited until it was out of sight before turning and heading for home. We had our first kiss about 4 feet from where we first met. Only now Mr. Glick's room was transformed for the Christmas dance. It was lit with Christmas lights, and all the chairs and desks had been pushed against the walls to form a dance floor in the center of the room. We hadn't talked at all since her dad drove home 48 hours earlier, but it didn't matter. We were both here, and we knew what was coming. There was no urgency. You don't need to cheer the sunset. It's gonna happen anyway. She danced with John DeGeorge. Didn't matter. I danced with Lisa too. Didn't matter. About an hour in, after a lot of fast dances culminating with Macho Man by the Village People, whoever was choosing the records put on How Deep Is Your Love by the Bee Gees. And I knew it was time. I walk over to her and hold out my hand. She takes it, and I lead her across the dance floor to the far end of the room, the darkest, most private corner beneath the American flag. Then, just as Barry Gibb begins to sing, I pull her in, and we sway imperceptibly to the most romantic song ever written or performed by any human beings in the history of the planet Earth. Then, just as he sings,
"'Cause we're living in a world of fools, breaking us down, when they all should let us be."
I lean back and look at her, and then we kiss for the very first time. And our connection is complete. I am hers. She is mine. We belong to you and me. Finally. I call her every day. We talk for hours. And after Christmas, I start reading to her from the Amityville Horror. Together, We move into the large, rambling Dutch colonial on Ocean Avenue. Together, we feel the odd, oppressive mood of the house bearing down on us. We wake every night at 3:15 and brace ourselves against the ice-cold Long Island wind and check the boathouse and lock its door for the 1,000th time. We see the mass of flies ripple and heave against the window panes of the sewing room. We endure the raging fevers and blistered palms of Father Mancuso, who suffers the tortures of the damned for doing nothing more than blessing the house for the Lutzes the week they move in. Together, we struggle to understand what the Lutzes are forced to experience in that house, and we imagine how we would feel sleeping in the very same rooms as the DeFeo family did on their very last night alive on Earth. Kim takes it and me very seriously. And I realize suddenly that she doesn't know the Richie Haddam that everyone else at Brightwood knows. She doesn't know me primarily as funny. And funny was really the only thing I had going at Brightwood. I was outgoing and always trying for a laugh. This was not considered cool or hot. Being sullen and quiet and inarticulate, like Eddie Minette, that was hot. Breaking rules and smoking and wearing Ocean Pacific shirts and a puka shell choker like Tim Gonzalez, that was hot. And those were things I could not pull off. You know who would have been hot at my school? Ronnie DeFeo. So what if he killed his whole family with a shotgun? He had a beard and emotional problems. Hot. But Kim was new at our school. And sure, I make her laugh, but for her, that's just one part of me. She also sees me as someone who knows a lot about the mysteries of the world. Ghosts and UFOs and Bigfoot, and those mysteries interest her too. It's my seriousness that she finds attractive. And this touches me in a way I can't express. It means the world to me. January 1979 is bliss. There are no dances, but we somehow find a way to touch each other every day, even if it's just her fingers grazing my arm as we pass each other in the hall, or my hand holding hers after school as we wait for her father's car to appear at the end of the block. And then we slowly separate so he will not know, and it is magic. Nothing hurts me anymore. Nothing scares me. I love and am loved. We tell each other I love you all the time, and we never question the truth or reality or wisdom of these words. We mean them every time we say them. It's the truest thing in our lives. And we laugh so hard, and we fight. But we're really just experimenting with another way to feel our love rise up in our hearts again, and it always does. I read The Amityville Horror a second time that month, just for myself this time. I want to re-experience those time bomb chapters again, each one ending with an explosion of terror. The book was so good. How could it be so good? I'd read a lot of books by then, but I hadn't fallen in love with a book before. This book was written as if Jay Anson wanted me to enjoy it. I didn't have to work hard. There were no boring parts I had to get through to earn the good parts. For some reason, the one moment that really got me was when George Lutz heard the blaring sounds of a marching band in the living room one night. He ran down, flipped on the lights, and the music instantly stopped. That's when he noticed that the rug had been rolled up and every single piece of furniture was pushed against the wall, quote, as if to make room for a lot of dancers, or a marching band. The chapter literally ends with an exclamation point. In fact, 12 of the 25 chapters in the Amityville Horror end in an exclamation point. Who does Jay Anson think he is? Ian Fleming? The second time through, I felt as if I knew the Lutz family. George, brooding and moody, always cold, constantly stoking the fire. Kathy, scared and somehow guilty, as with every passing day, she became more and more convinced that their dream house was a living nightmare bent on destroying them all. And the kids, Danny and Chris, the brothers, having their own mood swings, toggling between anger and fear, and Missy, the little girl, and that goddamn ghost pig, Jody. Maybe that's the part I identified with the most. No, not the pig. The feeling that they were losing their minds. The second time I read the book was definitely scarier than the first time, because I knew all the bad things that were coming, and I knew how it was all going to end. There was no question that Kim and I were going to the Valentine's Day dance together. By February, we were an established couple. And because Kim was friends with Gina and Lorraine, we were accepted into the circle of hot kid couples. For the first time ever at Brightwood, I was officially popular. I was even borderline cool. Tim and Eddie and even Kenny accepted me as a provisional equal. My funny thing was the thing that allowed them to let me be a part of their group. It was an acceptable role for me to play. Funny wasn't something they wanted to be, so it wasn't something that threatened them. About a week before the Valentine's Day dance, the phone rang. It was Kim, and she was crying. "We're moving." For a second, I couldn't process what she meant. Like, right now, I'm never going to see you again? She said her dad had gotten a job in Oregon, and she wasn't sure exactly when they'd be moving, but it could be soon. She might not even finish out the year at Brightwood. I was destroyed. I felt pre-abandoned. I felt whatever young people in love feel when circumstances intervene to tear them apart. I promised her that no matter what, our relationship would survive. We would do whatever we had to do to make sure that it did. And I'm certain that I did not hear any doubt or hesitancy in her voice when she agreed. I ramped up my game. For Valentine's Day, I bought her a bottle of Fabergé's Babe perfume and some kissing potion strawberry swirl lip gloss and a little gold heart necklace from the Save-On Pharmacy down in Atlantic Square. I insisted that my dad stay in the car so I could make these purchases privately with the money that he had just given me. I could not have been more self-conscious if I was buying flavored condoms. I wrapped these gifts in pink and red floral paper and tied them with gold ribbon. And I wrote her a letter declaring that nothing could or would ever come between us. Then I gave her the presents just before the dance. I sat there pulsating with emotion as she opened her gifts and then read the letter. It made her cry, and that is all I have ever wanted from my writing career. Then, both of us sobbing, we kissed and kissed for a very long time. And this became the script. This became what love was for me for the first 35 years of my life. Or maybe I should say this continued what love was for me. Connection, passion, completion. Loss, deprivation, desperation, grief, and rage. Rage, you say? What rage? Well, that was coming. Oh, my friends, that was coming. We pulled ourselves together as best we could, and then we went into the dance. We only danced with each other. By then, everyone at school knew that Kim was moving, so nobody got in our way. Each of our moments together now were numbered. People respected that. But the tragedy of what was happening elevated our love, not just in our own eyes, but in the eyes of everyone. Our love was star-crossed and therefore sanctified. And as much as the thought of her leaving hurt, it only redoubled our commitment to each other. The following Tuesday, I had a dentist appointment in the morning, and on occasions like this, my mom usually let me skip the entire day of school, which I happily did. The following morning, there was a definite ripple of silence and stares as I sat down in homeroom. And the minute we got up to switch classrooms, Debbie Tanaka could not wait to be the first to tell me. "Yesterday, after school, Kimberly kissed Kenny." Like most people, when they hear this kind of news, I had two simultaneous reactions. "That's impossible," and "of course." I went to find Kim as we changed classes, but as it turned out, she wasn't at school that day. So I had to suffer through an entire day of people staring at me and asking me how I was doing, before I had an opportunity to do the only thing in the world I wanted to do, talk to my girlfriend about what happened. I felt sick and dizzy and humiliated and heartbroken. And just in case, I started to feel a little angry. Just in case. I got home and I called her. The minute she got on the phone, I knew it was true. But I asked her anyway, and she admitted it. She had kissed Kenny. But why? Her voice took on an odd plaintive tone I'd never heard before. I'm sorry. He said he wanted to talk to me after school, so we talked, and he said he liked me, and then he just kissed me. I asked her if she kissed him back. I guess. I asked her if she liked him. I don't know. I hung up on her. And now the rage. I hated her more than I had ever hated anyone in my entire life. What we had was beyond special, beyond eternal, beyond any emotional bond that anyone had ever had. But somehow she just lost it, gave up on it. I didn't believe she hadn't felt it. Why take the best thing that had ever happened in your life and just throw it away? Because she isn't special. She's just like all the other kids. She's not capable of the exalted emotions that for me are just a part of my everyday life. But she is special. She was. She wasn't like the other kids. I couldn't have been that wrong. So what had happened? Did she just decide to be like everyone else? Was being in my elevated emotional realm ultimately too exhausting? Was she on drugs? There had to be a reason. I could feel it. But whatever it was just out of reach, hovering outside the cloud of misery and heartbreak and humiliation that surrounded me. Swirling inside that cloud were bits and pieces of anger, like shards of broken glass. And I grabbed every single one of them and held on tight, no matter how much it hurt. Anger was not something I was allowed to express at home, so I didn't express it anywhere. But I knew I needed it now for self-protection. It was the only thing that made me feel less humiliated. I decided to be angry at school. Apparently, me without a smile was an alarming sight, and people took notice, coming up to me and asking, "Are you okay? You look mad." I kind of hated playing into the adolescent drama of it all, but I wanted her to know how badly she had fucked up. I wanted her to feel the loss of my friendship and respect and love. I was so hurt. I wasn't going to have a screaming fight with her, but I wasn't going to let her off the hook either. I think her expectation was that I would want to talk to her. It made sense. For the last 2 months, we'd talked endlessly about everything. So instead, I behaved as if she didn't exist. I would talk to anyone and everyone but her. This was beyond being passive-aggressive. I was aggressively passive. But by the weekend, I realized this wasn't enough. You can only ignore someone so hard. So I came up with a plan. It was brilliant, and it was psychotic, and it could only have come from the brain of a hurt 12-year-old me. I waited 1 week. 1 week was typically how long any school drama had the gas to last. By then, whatever had happened between me and Kim was old news. There were other, fresher dramas to obsess over. I was pretty sure even Kim was moving on with her life. Well, not me. Starting the following Monday, after I got home from school, I called her house at exactly 3 o'clock and let the phone ring one time, and then I hung up. Then I did it again at 4, 5, and 6. Then I did it again the next day. I did it every day. I did it for weeks. Those of you too young to have ever lived with a landline, especially before phone answering machines were in common use, you probably have no way of understanding how unnerving this sort of thing was. It would be like someone pounding on your front door every hour on the hour, and every time you answered it, no one was there. Finally, one day, her dad must have been waiting, because the instant the phone rang, he picked it up quick and screamed, "Whoever this is!" And then I hung up. But those three words thrilled me, because it meant they weren't sure. They probably thought it was me, but they weren't sure. I didn't stop. There was no way anyone could ever prove I was doing this. It was a free local call, and it never went through anyway, so there was no record of the call ever being placed. Even the one time Kim's dad picked up, so what? That was one call. For all he knew, that was just a normal human being calling and then getting yelled at by him. After that, I started to get a busy signal. This meant that either they were taking their phone off the hook all afternoon, which would have been insane back then, because a phone was all you had. Or even better, what it meant was that they were waiting all afternoon, staring at the clock, and then going to the trouble of taking the phone off the hook just for a few minutes at the top of every hour from 3 to 6, which would be so incredibly inconvenient and insane that it filled me with delight. I considered every possibility. What if Kim's dad got my address from Kim and drove to my house and confronted my parents with his theory that I was calling their house every day at exactly 3, 4, 5, and 6 and then hanging up? He would never do it, because it would be insane. What adult would ever show up anywhere and accuse a 12-year-old of such baffling, pointless, and ultimately harmless behavior? But if he did, I would stare at him like he was insane, and I would deny it. Now, if he was smart, he'd come to my house just before the top of the hour, like say 3:57, and knock on my door and insist on talking to me and my parents all at once, just to make sure the conversation went past 4 o'clock. And then, again, if he was smart, go home and find out from Kim if the phone had rung at 4. Now, if it hadn't, he would have circumstantial proof that the caller was me, because I couldn't make the 4 o'clock call, because obviously I was busy talking to him. But the proof would only be circumstantial, and in any case, it wouldn't stop me. What was he going to do? Come to my house every day, every hour, from 3 to 6, just to keep me from calling his house? That would be amazing. Yeah, guys, I know. This was stalker behavior. What I was doing was horrible. I know that now. I just didn't know it then. And in my tiny poisoned brain, I told myself, I'm not hurting anyone. I'm not screaming at anyone or hitting anyone. Those were the ways you really hurt a person. I knew. I'd had plenty of firsthand experience. The final week of March was Play Days. This was the name given to a statewide week-long school curriculum designed around getting kids off their asses and out onto the playground to do fun, organized team competitions that would finally prove to all of us that exercise was groovy. Teams of 6 kids each were assembled randomly throughout the grade, so this would not be a case of homeroom against homeroom, or friend group against friend group. And ideally, all the naturally athletic kids would get evenly distributed among the weak, the halt, and the lame. Kim and I were placed on the same team. As kids wandered around the playground, clustering up, she came right up to me. We had not spoken for 6 weeks. "Hey," she said, "would it be okay if you and I could just be friends?" There was nothing coy or manipulative in this. It was very straightforward and sincere. I was completely disarmed, and for one of the only times in my life, I didn't know what to say. When I didn't answer her right away, she said, "Do you still hate me?" Wow. What could I say? If I said yes, that meant she still had power over me. But if I said no, that meant I had forgiven her. So still, I said nothing. "I'm not with Kenny, you know. Nothing ever happened after he kissed me. I don't like him." I didn't say anything. I was still trying to process. "Well, anyway," she said, "I'm sorry. I never meant to hurt you, even though I know I did. I just miss you and I wish we could be friends." I didn't say anything. So finally, she turned around and started walking away. "Hey, Kim," I called out. She turned around, and I said, "Yes, it's okay. We can be friends now." She gave me that same lopsided smile she gave me the very first day we fell in love. I felt a surge of emotion rise up in my chest, a longing for those days and those feelings that were gone now, but were the best I'd ever had. That afternoon, I called her house at 3 o'clock and let the phone ring once and hung up. And I did it again at 4 and 5 and 6. I did it for the rest of the week. I had to, you see. If I had stopped on the day we made up, she would have known it was me all along. Kim and I spent play days being friends, but we weren't really friends. And we weren't friends after that week either. We were just nothing. I don't remember much about the last 2 months of school. And by the end of the year, I was a little confused as to why I had ever loved Kimberly at all. She didn't move. She stayed at Brightwood for the rest of the year and all of 8th grade, and graduated with everyone else on June 12, 1980. It was a wonderful day. Her father was there, and so were my parents, and I gave a speech that got some laughs, and she looked beautiful, but we didn't speak. And after that day, I never saw her again. Years later, in various interviews, the Lutzes were asked repeatedly, "What does it mean to live in a haunted house? How does it really feel?" For George and Kathy Lutz, I imagine it was like being in a prison. You're free to leave at any time, but you don't want to leave. Things keep happening, and you think, "What's happening? Is this really happening? It can't be happening. There must be something wrong with me." Feelings take over, but are they coming from inside you or outside you? You're scared and embarrassed and angry, and the worst part is you doubt yourself. And when it's over and you're finally out of it, it's hard to recognize the person who endured it all as yourself. Maybe that's the scariest part of all. The degree to which you lose yourself. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time when we move the clock up to 2004, and I have one of the strangest experiences on a television show ever when I work on a TV show called True Calling. And we continue our Amityville Horror Mania with a book called The Amityville Horror Conspiracy. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.